Hi, this is Philip.
This is Chelsea.
This is Lindsay.
This is Katie.
And this is
Hanging with my cronies.
And so who of us got the flu vaccine this year?
I did.
I didn't.
Today we're going to be talking with Adrian, who is a manager here at Bio-Rad, and also a scientist. And he brings to the table not only knowledge of how vaccines are developed and made, but also a little bit of history and how vaccines were started to be developed by Dr. Edward Jenner, the father of immunology.
Not one of the Kardashian Jenners. Different one?
Different Jenner.
Okay.
But what goes into making vaccines?
Lots of hard work.
Yes. And
Chromatography!
There we go.
Yay.
So So I am here with Adrian Pineda, who is a manager and scientist here at Bio-Rad Labs, but has a history in vaccine developments. So can you tell me anything about your previous job? You know, who you worked for and what you did?
Sure. So I used to work for two vaccine manufacturers. One was a startup, and they used viral-mediated vectors to create vaccines. So that means that they used transgenic viruses and actually stuffed them with components of other viruses and bacteria to try and generate immune responses. And then most recently, I worked at a large manufacturer for vaccines, most specifically flu and a couple others. At this manufacturer, we used what's called recombinant protein vaccines. They're a form of a biologic, and they're one of the more common vaccines that you get pretty much whenever you go to the doctor.
So what goes into making a vaccine? Like, what are the steps from 1, 2, 3, 4 to getting the shot in the arm or wherever you get the shot?
Sure. So vaccine manufacturing and development is a really extensive process. It takes a long time. It starts early on with research and development, typically a disease that they want to cure, the flu, measles, mumps, whatever is plaguing humanity. They go through a little bit of R&D, trying to find a way to defeat the virus or the bacteria using our own immune system. So whatever proteins or DNA needs to be injected, that's what they're looking for, to get an immune response to make you immune to the virus. Once that's done and they've figured that out at a research and development stage.
How long does that take to actually figure that out?
Years, sometimes decades. A lot of that work is initially done in academic universities where they identify good targets to go after for immune responses, or maybe they do some of the initial mouse model work. Then once it gets to a company, it's years and years more research. You know, I think to take a drug to market from initial R&D, if it's at the manufacturing level, all the way through testing, 10 years to market. So, and that's once it gets to a manufacturer. That's not including the work that was done beforehand. So it takes a long time.
And is part of that research and development making sure that it's not just effective, but it's also safe?
Absolutely. So initial parts are done on mouse model systems. They're done with cell culture. Initially, they do a lot of toxicology studies on them to make sure the dosing isn't going to kill cells, isn't going to kill animals, that they're getting an effective immune response. Once they move from the animal or mouse model and they start going into humans, there's a very described way in which drugs are tested, and they go through phase trials. So there's phase one, phase two, phase three, and then release into the public. And so these case studies are very well controlled. So the initial phase one, they're usually looking at toxicology. Will healthy people withstand the dosage? What kind of level they can inject someone with before side effects are seen? And where the best crossover is really between effectiveness and side effect. And that's what they're looking for, is how do you get the best immune response in the most amount of people with the least amount of side effects? Once that happens, they start expanding the trials to larger and larger populations with more and more diverse biological backgrounds. So initially, you might think they're looking at healthy individuals. They may be looking at a certain population mix. But then as they expand it, because most vaccines are intended to go to the entire global population, then they start adding in diversity and start randomizing, not randomizing, but they start selecting a little less carefully who's involved because they want results that will mimic the natural population. During that entire time, they study every single side effect, everything that happens is noted, whether it happened in the control group, which is people who are not injected, versus people who are injected and what their side effects are. And those are always reported after the test.
So are those the side effects that you see the laundry list whenever you watch a commercial and you see, you know, that the side effects may include headache, dizziness, you know, that laundry list that happens on those? Is that what's being reported as any side effect that happens during the study?
Any side effect.
Any side effect.
Any side effect. And they're not removing the control side effects as well and saying, well, this group had headaches and that group had headaches, so we're not going to report it. They still report it. What they do look at is kind of the more serious events. That's when they start pulling it out. So if you start seeing deaths because of the vaccine, they're going to want to compare that to deaths on the other side. But yeah, that laundry list of precautions is really just them saying this is all of the things that happened. And maybe by the time they get to a phase three trial, you're talking hundreds of thousands of people may have been injected with this. And you can imagine if you're going to follow somebody for 1, 3, 5 years to find out how long the effect is going to take, people are going to have things that happen to them that are not related to the vaccine itself. And those are still recorded because it's part of the clarity of the drug. These are highly regulated, highly investigated drugs.
Going to how vaccines started way back at the very beginning, do you have knowledge of how safe were they back in the day versus how they are now?
So one of the things to think about with vaccine safety, because there are a lot of people who talk, I want safer vaccines, or they want to know what the side effects are. Vaccines have probably the highest safety standard of any drugs on the market. And the reason being is if you had some type of pathology, if you were sick, let's say you had heart disease, and I wanted to give you a drug, you're going to look at that drug and say, heart disease is going to kill me. What's the side effect of the drug? Well, as long as it's not death, you're going to be pretty likely to take it. So the companies know that your threshold for risk is much higher than if you were healthy. Now, if you're completely healthy and I say, hey, Chelsea, here's a drug and I'm going to give it to you and you know there's a list of side effects, you're a lot less likely to take it because you're currently completely healthy. They really go through an effort to make sure they're safe when they give it to you because they're giving it to healthy people. And no one wants a drug to make a healthy person sick. They wouldn't sell it anymore.
They wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, exactly. No one would buy it. They'd say, well, maybe I can get sick from the flu, but yeah, this thing's going to get me sick too, so I don't really want to take it.
All right, so speaking, you brought up the flu, and you've worked on flu vaccine development.
Mm-hmm.
What is different? Because you get a flu vaccine every year, right? I mean, I think you've had the flu vaccine this year.
I have.
And, you know, sometimes it protects you, sometimes it doesn't. What makes it different? You know, why do people need to keep going back year after year after year to actually get the flu vaccine?
Sure. So there's a couple reasons. So I did get the flu vaccine this year, and I also got the flu. you know, I'm definitely one of those individuals that got vaccinated and got the flu. What I can tell you is that the flu vaccine I received only had about 3, 4, or maybe 5 flu in it that I would be protected against.
Uh-huh.
And that's if my body created an immune response to every single strain that was in there.
Okay.
Now, there are several things that affect the efficacy of a flu shot, which means how effective it is. One of them is, did they actually inoculate me with a flu strain that I contracted? I don't know because they didn't type the flu that I got. So maybe it wasn't included in that flu vaccine, which is exactly why I got it. There are hundreds of different flus out there. Any one of them could get you sick if you're not immune to it. The second reason I could have gotten sick is my own genetics. It's very possible that I was inoculated with the right strain and my body just didn't convert for some reason. All vaccines have a fail rate. The flu is one of the higher fail rates of the vaccines, and that's due to the third reason why the flu doesn't always work. So unlike most vaccines that are tested for a decade, that they're looking for the perfect antigen, which gives them the highest percentage chance of converting somebody to immune, they spend enormous amounts of money doing that and time. And then when they get it, it's a vaccine that you take once and usually you're done or you get a booster. That's because the virus itself doesn't change over time. Unfortunately, the flu does change. The flu undergoes two types of changes. One is called antigenic shift and the other is called antigenic drift. Either one of those allows the flu to escape your immune system. So that's why we need a new flu every single year, a new vaccine, because a new one shifts or drifts away from the old vaccine, and you're no longer immune to it.
So the flu's kind of like a tricky little guy.
It is. The moment you know what they look like, they change their appearance, like they're some secret agent, and all of a sudden they get by you.
Oh, man. So in actually developing the vaccine, you know, you have the target and then you have to take, grow it up, I'm guessing, and then somehow purify that, right? So what are the steps in that?
Well, depends on which flu you get.
Okay.
So this is another reason why flu vaccines are not always effective. So as I said before, every year the flu changes. So every year they make a new vaccine. Because they make a new vaccine every single year, they can't test it. It's not as good. When they do make it finally, the vast majority of flu vaccines are manufactured in eggs. So they take a flu vaccine that infects humans, they merge it with a flu that infects chickens, and they create this kind of seed virus that they then inject into eggs.
This sounds like the start of a zombie movie right now.
It most certainly does. You've got a chicken flu that you've kind of created in a lab, and now you have to infect chicken eggs.
Okay.
You harvest the flu from the chicken egg. You purify the proteins that you need, and you create a vaccine. Well, flu doesn't replicate in a chicken. It replicates in us when we generate an immune system to it. Okay. And there are just differences in the way proteins are modified within a chicken compared to a human. And so sometimes we get a virus that grows in a chicken. But then once you put it in a human, the human doesn't create the proper immune response. That's why you hear things like, oh, this year's flu vaccine wasn't very good, or it had a very low efficacy rate. There was something about the way that vaccine was made that it just wasn't ideal for humans. They don't test them because they have very little time from when they detect a bad flu strain somewhere in the world and becoming the new predominant flu of the year. They have from then until usually less than 6 to 9 months before it started spreading across the entire globe. And so that's how long they have to develop it.
Okay.
So that's one type of flu vaccine. The other type is made in cell culture. And there are several companies that are doing this. This is what I used to do was I worked at a company who was manufacturing flu on cell culture. So cell cultures use mammalian cells. So they're a lot closer to us in what they manufacture. And they tend to give a little bit better immune response. At least that's what some of the research is showing. So it depends on which one you get, how it's made. There's a lot of things that affect how good the flu vaccine itself is.
So if, you know, they growing them in the tissue culture cells is more similar to it being in humans, why is egg production of flu vaccines still being used, do you think?
Because it's a 70-year-old technology.
7 or 70?
70.
70 years.
Yes.
Okay.
It's about 60 to 70 years old that they've been doing this. It's cheaper right now because they've been doing it for so long. And I think it's just a better known technology. The big disadvantage to it, even though it's a very mature technology, is that on occasion, we had this happen a few years ago, there was a chicken flu epidemic, and people were killing chickens by the billions. Well, that made the cost of chicken eggs skyrocket. If you remember a few years ago, chickens were kind of scarce, and it was hard to get eggs. It also drove the cost of the flu vaccine up. So if we were to ever have a flu outbreak that did wipe out bird populations, our source to make the vaccine itself would be gone.
And so would omelets.
Yes.
Oh, history of vaccines. So yeah. What do you know about the history of vaccines?
Oh, they have a great history. So vaccines were first developed by Jenner. So Jenner was a physician back in the days. When he was a physician, smallpox was kind of ravaging the world a lot.
That's right. I think it was 2 to 3 people out of 10 that it infected, it killed.
Yeah. And so it was a really high death rate. And what Jenner noticed was that milkmaids seemed to be immune to getting smallpox. So he did a little work, and he noticed that the milkmaids would get these blisters on their hands, and that the blisters were from cowpox, which was a known virus at the time, or a known disease at least, and it had similar features to smallpox. It created pus-filled blisters on the udders of the cow. So the milkmaids would get little pus blisters on their hands when they would first get exposed to cowpox. Then they would never get smallpox after that. And so he started putting 2 to 2 together and thought, you know, maybe it's infection with cowpox that makes us immune to smallpox. So we found a boy. It turned out to be an 8-year-old boy that was the son of his gardener. And he asked permission if he could vaccinate him. And what they did is they took the child over to a milkmaid. They looked for the pus on the hands of the milkmaid, and then they took little pieces of the pus and would actually insert it under the skin of the boy. And then that would give him an infection. And that was one thing, you know, people knew that you could give a disease from one person to another.
Yeah.
But what the game changer was, and if you try to do this today, I cannot imagine what the outrage would be. But he then exposed the boy intentionally to smallpox to make sure that he wouldn't get sick. And then they repeated this something like 20 or 30 more times to prove that this was really how it was done. So initial smallpox vaccine was simply transferring the pus from cowpox to individuals. Something that we talk about in the vaccine world, or I've certainly talked about with coworkers, is that, you know, 50, 60 years ago, or if possibly you went to a country that doesn't have a lot of vaccines now, you're going to see people walking around everywhere that has diseases that are preventable by vaccines. Like polio 80, 90 years ago, you're going to see, or I guess it's polio would have been 100 years ago, you're going to see kids that are crippled, you're going to see adults in iron lungs. You don't see that anymore. Vaccines are now so effective, people don't really believe that the diseases they prevent are that severe anymore because they don't see it. So in essence, vaccines are kind of hindered by their own success. They've been so wildly successful at curing all of these diseases that used to be endemic within the last 200 years that everybody's forgotten what it's like to see that. So people don't really understand the real severity that these diseases bring. It's not just a cough and you're okay.
That's a very good point. The vaccines have kind of buffered us from being able to see what the diseases actually can cause. You know, we don't see that. Do you know any differences between the U.S. and the rest of the world in terms of the vaccines that we give here versus everywhere else?
Sure. One of the most popular vaccines that varies in the U.S. Versus the rest of the world is the polio vaccine. So I think a lot of us probably remember sugar cubes when we were younger or hearing stories about being given sugar cubes for the polio vaccine.
I've heard stories, but I was given the shot.
You were given the shot. Okay, I was definitely given the cubes. I remember that. The sugar cubes are still given all over the world. So that's the oral polio vaccine, the OPV. The oral polio vaccine is really popular because it's cheaper. So countries that don't have quite as much money as we do can get 10 to 20 times the number vaccinated per dollar amount spent. So it's much cheaper for other countries to do. The reasons we don't use it in the U.S. is that this is a live attenuated virus. So they took the polio vaccine, they cultured in a lot of different animals to make it really weak at infecting humans and really good at infecting other animals. They then gave those vaccines to individuals. You eat it, it's alive, but it's pretty weak. In almost all people that take it, they don't get polio. But I think it's about 1 in 2 million actually develops polio from the vaccine itself and then is capable of infecting other people. So we don't do that here in the U.S. We use the IPV, which is the inactivated polio vaccine. So that's the shot, goes into your arm. Like I said, it's a little bit more expensive, but this is dead polio virus. It's not capable of replicating. But when you get this injection, it's a little bit more effective.
So in manufacturing vaccines, what are the different purification steps and how is it done? And are there, you know, what methods are used?
Sure. So I was listening to a previous podcast where you talked about the first biologic, which was insulin. So the vast majority of vaccines that are made are biologics themselves. These are bioactive molecules. They have to be produced and purified. And much like insulin, they use chromatography for the main production and purification process. There are very few ways that you could get a sample as pure without chromatography. It really depends on the vaccine, what steps in chromatography, but they're going to use all of the standard ones, ion exchange. They're going to do, that's going to be the main one. They might use mixed mode like CHT resins. I know those are used in a lot of different vaccines like Gardasil. And then beyond that, it's just going to be your standard biologics manufacturing.
So you mentioned the fact that you can orally ingest something and develop a antibody response to it. You know, parents in the U.S. have gotten very defensive of all of the shots and vaccines that they're giving their children and that it's a little bit too aggressive. But can you talk about the fact that, you know, how ingesting something still is generating an immunologic response?
Sure. We all eat things every day. We've all eaten something and gotten sick from it. So that creates an immune response right in of itself. If you've ever had food poisoning, your body created an immune response. That's a time where you actually got sick, and you knew about that. But there are many times a day where maybe you touched something and you put it into your mouth and didn't realize it, or you ate some food in a place you've never been to, and it didn't make you sick, but your immune system was still exposed to those hundreds of bacteria and viruses every single day. Our body spends an enormous amount of effort defending our GI tract from viruses, because the two most common ways to get a pathogen in is into your lungs or through your mouth. And we have gigantic immune sensing regions in our intestines, in our colon, that survey all of the pathogens that are in there. They're not accustomed to seeing one. They're accustomed to seeing thousands. And so eating a vaccine would be a very normal and natural way that the body would encounter a virus anyways. So putting it in a sugar cube would be a very reasonable thing to do.
And so for children, this is a very natural, like their immune system is constantly making antibodies to everything they put in their mouth.
If you think about a baby, it's in a womb for 9 to 10 months, and it develops in, I wouldn't call it sterile, but a pretty sterile environment. It's only going to get what the mother's exposed to. Then it's born and immediately has contact with humans. It has contact with doctors, starts putting things in its mouth. And so the baby, from the moment that it's born, starts ingesting pathogens immediately. The immune system kicks off and starts adapting to these, responding to them appropriately. Their immune system is in peak form until they're about 2. And during this time at 2, this is when you see a lot more sickness just from the wild. It's also where their body's learning what to fight and what not to fight. So I would say that babies go through this probably every minute of their life, being attacked by pathogens and having their immune system respond.
So we've seen an increase in the number of unvaccinated persons, especially amongst children. And we are also seeing a rise in the number of cases of the measles, for example. You know, what is the link between these two things?
Sure. Well, it's a direct link. All of these vaccines have had extensive research on them. Epidemiologists spend a lot of time figuring out what the correct number of people that need to be vaccinated is. This is based on how effective the vaccine is. And once you get to this kind of critical number for a vaccine, they call it herd immunity. Once X percentage of the population is vaccinated, then it confers a much larger group of people that are immune. So the concept of herd immunity is pretty simple. In order for somebody to get a virus, they have to be near a virus. So if we had a room of 100 people and only 10 people in there were vaccinated, it'd be pretty easy for one person to bump into somebody in that room and give them the virus. Now, if you say have 97% of that room vaccinated and there are only 3 that are not, maybe they're immunocompromised or they've got some other health situation where they can't take it. The chance that an infected individual, so it would be one of those 3 people, would randomly bump into one of the other 2 people in the room that are unvaccinated is very low. And so even though 97% of the room is vaccinated, in essence, those 2 are unlikely to get infected. And that's what's occurring in these areas. People aren't getting the measles vaccines. And because of that, they're dropping below that critical threshold for herd immunity. And that increases the chances of passing it to somebody who may be a child who has cancer or some other immune compromising disease. And now they're going to get infected because they didn't have the opportunity to get vaccinated.
Final, we should talk about the elephant in the room in terms of the paper that was scientifically disproven as well as being shown as scientifically unfound. But, you know, why should people not be concerned about this, you know, that don't necessarily have scientific degrees like we do?
Sure. So I would say that, you know, it's certainly smart to always be concerned about whatever drug or vaccine you put in your body because things can have side effects. Autism, however, is not one of the side effects that have been shown for vaccines. The link to autism was shown by a doctor who had some nefarious reasons of his own, I believe, for casting aspersions on the MMR vaccine at the time. This individual was trying to market their own MMR vaccine. So, you know, the where it started from, I would say didn't have the best of intentions. And I think it kind of steamrolled for there. Like I talked before, anytime you put a drug in your body when you're not sick, people worry about it. Here was somebody saying, if you're a completely healthy individual and you take this vaccine, you may get autism or some of these other effects. And it had exactly the effect that he wanted it to, which is people now started doubting MMR. From there, it grew to, well, it's not just MMR, it's other vaccines, because they started thinking, well, it's the adjuvant that's used, or it's just vaccine technology in general is going to cause this. So it's really ballooned from that initial claim, but that's where it came from. And I would say that as a scientist, one, it really bothers me when people lie. I know it happens in the world, but it's our job to tell the truth and let people decide what they want to do from that. When we start making things up out of convenience, it really casts a doubt on the entire science, which is exactly what has happened. The other thing that's a little bothersome about it is that there are now people who are not getting vaccinated for it. There's no link to autism. We've spent enormous amounts of money. You can go online. They are now doing 100,000 to multi-million person studies to find links of vaccine issues with autism or other neuropathologies, and they cannot find it. So not only was the claim kind of spurious to begin with, it's now diverted enormous amounts of effort and money trying to disprove a claim that was never true to begin with.
All right. Thank you so much, Adrian, for coming in and talking with me today.
Not a problem.
A really interesting part of your interview with Adrian for me was talking about the milkmaid. You know, they took the cowpox from the milkmaid pus and they used that as a treatment for smallpox, right?
Correct.
And it kind of reminded me of something that happened way before Jenner, which was the Revolutionary War, where they were doing similar, but they were just taking soldiers who were infected in order to inoculate other soldiers.
Yeah, and the way that they would inoculate them was through this method called variolation, where they would either take the pus and rub it on an open wound, or, even more palatable, they would snort the pus.
What are the symptoms of smallpox?
So first of all, smallpox is very deadly. It would kill three to four people per 10 that it infected. So it was a very high mortality rate. You would basically get, you know, pox all over your body. Whereas with cowpox, you would just get them on your hands, mm-hmm. where you actually would touch the udders of the cow. But it was a very deadly disease. However, they found whenever you would do this variolation, where you would basically infect either, you know, a high amount of virus into the nasal cavity would stimulate a very drastic immune response very instantaneously, rather than going through the actual course of being infected the normal way.
Right.
And same way with being putting it onto an open wound, it actually gave our immune system enough time to respond to it so that it could fight it off. And so it went from being, you know, 3 in 10 or 3 to 4 people in 10 dying of this to 3 people out of 100.
Wow.
That is the difference.
So the efficacy of vaccinations then.
Yeah.
Low level exposure.
Yep.
Develop an immune response.
Mm-hmm.
So how did they get chickenpox? Who was milking the chickens to get that? So that would be challenging.
So if you're weighing your options, snort pus or take your chances with smallpox?
I would snort pus.
I would take my chances.
Of course you would.
Or get back on the boat and sail back to England.
So back to the topic of the Revolutionary War, this was an order that was handed down from General Washington. And it was done because both Benjamin Franklin and Benedict Arnold had actually thought we were going to lose the war, not due to the battles against Great Britain, but because of smallpox.
Which, really? It was that prevalent?
It was that prevalent and that deadly. The other thing that I like to talk about with vaccination is the fact that the way that using attenuated virus or weakened virus actually came about was by a guy of the name of Louis Pasteur. Which I think we've all heard of. We all drink pasteurized milk, right? Well, I don't because I can't drink milk, but...
Yeah, we know.
You know what I mean. And so he had a technician that was actually supposed to inject chickens with, I believe it, yeah, it was smallpox. and the technician was about to go on vacation.
I've heard this.
Yep. And he forgot. And then when he came back, he was like, oh no. So he injected the chickens with the virus that had been sitting around for 2 or 3 weeks or something like that.
And thereby was weakened.
And the chickens didn't die. And that was the first time that had happened. And then they went back and they injected the chickens with fresh virus, you know, a month later after they had prepared it. And again, the chickens didn't die. And it was because they had been first exposed to a weakened virus. And that's where the entire vaccination protocol came from, is let's take a virus, we know that it causes this bad infection, let's weaken it, stick it in people, and then they're protected against the actual stronger virus.
It's really cool. It kind of proves that point, right? It's okay to make mistakes, and sometimes it's a good thing when it comes to science as well.
So there's hope for all those lazy technicians all over the world. Keep slacking.
Moral of the story is we need more vacation.
That is definitely true in the U.S.
Great.
So, Philip, since you're the oldest one here in the bunch.
I am, but I wasn't around during the Revolutionary War. Make that clear.
Adrian also talked about polio vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a sugar cube or did you get a shot?
Lump? Sugar lump? That sugar was lump? Where it was at. Yeah, sugar lump.
Was it like on your shoulder?
No.
The lump?
No. A cube of sugar with this yellowish liquid put on that you had to... Yes.
Did it taste good?
No, it tasted awful.
But it was sugar.
But it was sugar coated in polio vaccine.
Mm.
Why did you people, you...
You people!
You
people.
Millennials or whatever we call you. No sugar lumps here?
I remember getting the shot.
Oh, did you have it on Splendor lumps instead?
Stevia lumps.
Stevia.
We don't call them lumps here. Something that we talked about, I think, after your interview with Adrian, so I don't think we actually caught this, is the topic that he had brought up about the chickenpox parties. He had mentioned that some people actually have their children suck on a lollipop when they have chicken pox and then will mail that licked lollipop to other people who want to buy it to avoid vaccinations for their children. And that, if true, blew my mind.
Yeah, I can't believe, you know, you don't trust a doctor to inject your child with a vaccine, but you trust some stranger to ship you a lollipop that's been licked on by their own kid that has chicken pox?
And is the vaccine still good? I guess it's attenuated at that point, probably, after it's been shipped. But yeah, what's the efficacy? And
this has not happened, I think, in the last 20 or 30 years, because I know that didn't happen while I was growing up. But I remember reading books whenever I was in junior high, I think, about, you know, the fact that kids would go and try, and they would have their parents go and try and actually get, they would have these chickenpox parties or measles parties or mumps parties or things like that. Mm-hmm. And
I've never heard of this. Sounds crazy to me, but like, I feel like I've just missed this growing up.
Yeah, it was something that I think happened in the 60s and 70s. Where you would go and you would try and get your child to be,
wow,
go ahead and get the infection over with. In fact, I have a friend that his mother would send him over to get chickenpox, mm-hmm, and he never ever caught it. Like, he never actually had chickenpox, and he had to keep going over to these friends' houses where the kid didn't feel very good, didn't really want to play, but he had to hang out with them.
Well, it beats rubbing pus all over yourself, but
still, so, like, now we have the vaccines, which means these parties are not necessary, and there's no reason to actually have these.
But we're having one for Katie's next birthday, we've decided. We're having a chickenpox party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will not attend.
We will be sharing chapsticks.
Or with Philip, we could have a flu vaccination party since he's not ever getting the shot. Ooh.
So, no, because Adrian talked about inoculation, that kids do naturally just growing up, because they crawl around on the floor, like little, you know, babies, infants, they crawl around on the floor and they touch things and put things in their mouths, and that's actually good for them. So I found that really interesting, that, you know, that makes sense, you know, to kind of, like we were talking about, you know, eating dirt and mm-hmm stuff is good for you, it helps your immune system. So that was kind of,
yeah, I mean, I think that's fact. Part of the reason why autoimmune disorders are so prevalent in the Western world but not in the developing world is because we don't expose ourselves or our kids to mm-hmm. pathogens and things like this when they're growing up. I think it's good as well to hear from Adrian just how much time development and testing goes into vaccines. You know, in the popular media, that you see these scare stories and things that have very detrimental effects on people, whereas the reality is very different. And if people took the time to actually read the science behind these sorts of cases, then, you know, it should take away a lot of the fear.
I think another interesting point that he had was the fact that we don't walk around and we don't see iron lungs anymore. We don't see people that are actually having to deal with these debilitating diseases now. Mm-hmm. We, you know, we have these vaccinations and we don't see the repercussions of the actual illness anymore. And so people have lost that fear of actually having the illness.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, now we're seeing things like in the United States, these big measles outbreaks because we haven't maybe been as responsible as a community as we should be. So hopefully we don't start to see some of these more... I don't want to say more negative because measles is pretty bad.
It's like older.
But some of these other things, yeah.
Right, diseases that we thought we'd cured are now starting to come back.
Right, because they said measles was like...
eliminated.
Eliminated, right? Mm-hmm. Now we're having these big like pockets pop up, at least in the U.S., where there's a lot of children and people who are showing up with measles.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got to respect the parents' rights to decide what they feel is best, but it doesn't just affect their child.
Yeah.
When you're looking at contagious diseases.
Herd immunity is important.
For protecting the entire population.
Right.
By using chromatography, it separates out everything that is extra from that prep to just those viral particles that we need to develop the immune response to.
I think that's the key point, right? Like the primary uses of chromatography are either to characterize or to identify certain parts of a biologic, or more common in what we work on is to purify. So to make sure just what we want in that drug is what at the final stage is there. That purification step is part of the manufacturing process. And looking at the market and where we've evolved from, you know, reverse phase chromatography was very important with small molecules. Now for biologics, we have things like ion exchange and hydrophobic interaction. And even further development for viruses and vaccines now, we're creating new kinds of technologies, new resins, which afford for these very large molecules, which is what we see with viruses and vaccines so often. So both on the technology side and the development side, there is a lot of work to make sure that it is just what we want to deliver to these patients.
And that's truly one of the strengths of chromatography, is a selectivity based upon the characteristic of the protein or the biomolecule.
That's a great point, yeah.
You're looking to isolate.
So I'd like to thank Adrian Pineda for being my guest today and talking to me about vaccine development. And I'd also like to thank you, the listener, for listening to this podcast. Please remember to subscribe on bioradiations.com, as well as follow BioRad on our YouTube channel. And thanks for hanging with us.
This podcast is an original creation of BioRad Laboratories. BioRad is a trademark of BioRad Laboratories Incorporated in certain jurisdictions. All trademarks mentioned herein are the property of their respective owner.